But last month's audio recording didn't come out. So I'm giving it again. And this series of talks, tonight being fear, complements the special Friday night classes on the Yogacara teachings, the consciousness-only teachings, which details 100 different dharmas, 51 of which are mental states. This particular philosophical school within Buddhism topologizes, hierarchizes 51 possible major mental states. Of course, there are numerous mental states, but the 51, both wholesome, unwholesome, indeterminate, omnipresent, and object ascertaining, all of these possible mental states that shape our lives, and provide possibility for further bondage, suffering, or liberation. The context in which this set of teachings were given is very foreign to our modern life. We're talking thousands of years ago. And there are many important emotions in how we value that are not included in this set. And so we've decided to use the first Monday of the month talks for the duration of next year or however long to cover these emotions. And the first of which is fear. Now you may wonder, why isn't fear covered in the traditional mental states? Don't they recognize that fear is very important? It practically runs our lives. Yeah. So we can only conjecture. The people that developed this is not here to answer our questions. But we can recognize that when they developed these systems of Buddhist psychology, they were not concerned with detailing every possible emotions. They were concerned with the major ones that causes suffering and the ones that produces liberation. And the ones that cause suffering is understood within a particular context as well. It's not just ordinary suffering. Because if they were to detail ordinary suffering, fear will make it to the top 10 list. The mental states, the listing of these mental states were developed around the Buddha's teaching. And the Buddha said, the causes of suffering come from the three poisons of the mind: greed, aversion, and fundamental ignorance. Fundamental ignorance is very difficult to tackle. It doesn't refer to low intelligence. It refers to basically the unenlightened mind. So it's basically pervasive in all of our choices. The inability to see how things exist, how things are. And by that they mean two particular insights experiential insights. One is dependent origination, which means all things are intimately connected to one another. They serve as causal conditions for one another. Two is impermanence. Impermanence. All things exist in flux. Of course, we all understand this. But somehow we don't make our life choices. We don't prioritize what is most important in our lives around these fundamental truths. So we act against the grain. We go against the grain. Against the flow of impermanence. Instead of seeing things as interconnected, we have a tendency to reify things, reify phenomena into discrete things. Things that we can possess and things that we can reject. Because this fundamental ignorance is extremely hard to perceive. Usually, the Buddhist tradition teaches methods and concepts to tackle the first two of the three poisons, which is craving or desire or greed, and aversion or hatred. Two sides of the same coin. This is more easily perceivable. Whatever anguish, misery, suffering that we feel, or vexations, now that we feel, all of you feel, basically can be summed up as you want this moment to be other than what it is. That is greed and aversion. You want this to be other than what it is. You have to think about it. You have to observe by yourself. When you have suffering, the basis of this is basically can be summed up in this. Wanting this to be other than what it is craving for the other. And rejecting of now what you have. When you say, why me? Why is this happening to me? Why can it happen to someone else? This why me? Rejection of this means you already want something else. Does that make sense? So all the mental states, the wholesome mental states, unwholesome mental states evolve around the three poisons and the overcoming of the three poisons. So the consciousness only school does not list every possible mental state there is, it would be impossible. They only deal with the three poisons of the mind. So it belongs to the commentarial tradition, you see, these philosophical schools. Commentary on the words of the Buddha. Does that make sense? So, something like fear is not covered in this particular list developed by this school. But in the scriptures, the Buddha talk about many different kinds of fears, different objects, and how to overcome them. So I'll be drawing on the scriptures directly. And just so you know, if you would like to hear a talk on a particular emotion, you can send it to our email. And it will be added to the list. I should begin by saying that the emotions that we feel are also seen from wisdom, as opposed to ignorance, fundamental ignorance. The emotions that we feel also have two distinct qualities. Can you guess what they are? I was saying the fundamental ignorance is defined by two distinct qualities. One is what? Level? We tend to reify things, right? Into discrete things as opposed to seeing them as dependent origination. That's a kind of a spatial view. Syncretic view, that all things are interconnected. The temporal view would be what? Impermanence. Okay. That would be fundamental ignorance, seeing things as permanent, discrete, reified things out there. So fear, like any other emotion, and every other state, seen from the eyes of wisdom, is they too pass. They come and they go. How? Dependent on various conditions. Today, if something that come and go, something that's transient, do they define us? Can we define ourselves through something that's transient? No. But the reality of our lives is that we know ourselves, define ourselves through these emotions. These are what we have ever known about us. This is what we have ever known about us. All these emotions that come and go. That's what I mean by reification, solidification. Into narratives, into stories, our autobiographical sense of self. Because we reify these feelings that we have, such as fear, they become the most important thing. In other words, we make a big deal out of them. So, I've said this once. Only once. I don't want to scare people. So I only said this once. It was during retreat, I think. I said, emotions are overrated. Any of you remember me saying that? Yeah. You haven't been on that particular retreat, that particular one. Yeah. closely tied to fear is our narratives. From accumulated experiences. Of who we are. What we wish. Our ability to anticipate the future is also closely tied to this autobiographical sense of self that we feel. Anticipation of the future. And that which we have reified and accumulated in the past. So perhaps the most fundamental fear is non-existence, which manifests differently under different circumstances. Our own end. And because it's tied to our sense of self, what we have accumulated and what we anticipate in the past, in the future. And if we see that that future is leading to death, non-existence, then we have fear. And it's disguised by this fear of non-existence, fear of own death. It's disguised variously through your ordinary living. For example, what kind of fear do you have? Maybe fear of rattlesnake, fear of bugs, fear of heights, fear of small spaces, fear of people. Yeah. What else?
Illness.
Fear of illness. Fear of driving in Orlando. You haven't driven in New York City or Taiwan, have you? Who said that? Boston. That's Boston. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
So all of these things, at the core, is something's going to happen to you. Yeah. What is that which is going to happen? You may get harmed. And by extension, possibly, you may not exist. You may lose everything. So, fear is tied to anticipating the future and that which we have accumulated, amassed in the past. In the center, this is self-referentiality, self-grasping. Which means this reification of self-image. Ideas of who you are, right? Which is narratives, stories. Does that exist?
No.
conventionally, yeah, we needed to navigate our daily life, you know, your understanding of who you are. But ultimately, the self that we tend to hold on is a skewed notion of who we are. It's a reified, skewed, highly selective result of who we think we are. That, Buddhism says, does not exist. That does not exist. Our own opinion, our own feelings, our own experiences, everything that we think defines us come from everything else. It's connected to everything else. And you continue to evolve and change. But somehow, we are hardwired to solidify these things into something solid. Something unchanging. And because of this grasping, it's not the event, it's not the accumulated experiences, nor is it our views about things, our understanding. It's this grasping. As soon as there's grasping, it goes against the flow of flux, of change. And it goes against the flow of interconnectedness. And that's where anguish arises. So, as I said, the core of this is fear of death, fear of non-existence. That comes from the view and understanding that there's nothing afterwards, or there's nothing knowable. As if whatever you have experienced, accumulated, amounts to nothing. Right. Amounts to an ending. But Buddhism teaches that it doesn't end. And it has no beginning. And if we observe the natural world, things, if there's a end in something, then there should be a beginning of something. Like a beginning point. Which means, prior to the beginning point, there's nothing. Suddenly, spontaneously, it begins. There is no cause for it. So, is there anything in the world that comes into being without cause? Spontaneous. Spontaneous birth. Come from nothing and then just suddenly appears. You may say fetus. Fetus, the first instance of consciousness. Where does that come from? Does it come from nothing? First instance of synaptic, neurological So Buddhism, that's why Buddhism says that everything comes about through causes and conditions, and causes and effect. So cause and effect is a temporal view. Causes and conditions is a spatial view. Cause can only lead to effect through conditions. If you have a seed, that's a cause, can only blossom into a flower through conditions. It has potential, but it does not necessarily lead to a flower. Conditions are, you had to put in soil, you had to have rain, you had to give it sunshine, the nourishment, then it will blossom. So, temporally, cause leading to effect must have spatially the conditions that brings it forth. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, therefore, the first instance of consciousness is an effect. Which in turn itself becomes cause. But the first instance is an effect. Effect comes from causes and conditions originating in a previous cause. Hence the Buddhist establishment of the theory of rebirth. So this life, its very beginning to the end, is an instance, like a second in a movie. And we have missed the previous part of the movie. It's like walking into the movie theater, we only see a second. We try to make sense of it. That's why it doesn't make sense. That's why our life doesn't make sense. What seems to be the protagonist, it's actually not. What seems to be the hero in this movie, it's actually just a minor role. If we understand the whole movie, then we will see the causal connections between people and between things. But dealing with this life, it seems chaotic. It seems random. Things are not how we want it to be. Right? We may work very hard, but the condition is just not there. Someone else doesn't work hard. Things are handed to him or her. Right? We're getting a split second of that movie, film, this. And it seems like we're not really the author of this film. It's just ongoing. Right? Why is that? Because it's intimately connected to all people. Right. Who is the author? It's very hard to determine, because authorship entails as if one person is writing a script or something. Right. Your writing of the script is continually being influenced by other people's scripts. It's like a complicated, complex, collaborative, you know, story that seemed to lead to unexpected results. Right? And because of this, and our experiential sense of this, since we're young, since we're babies growing up in this sea of chaos, in order to survive, we desperately hold on to things, reify them, right, solidify them, to provide a sense of security in this flow. The truth is, this teaching of dependent origination, causes and conditions, spatially, and impermanence of cause and effect. And the truth is freedom. Moment to moment freedom. That's how things are. Things, people, they're free. The bondage comes from us trying to control, possess, define, attach. We need healthy attachments, right? Help us navigate. The advocated living right livelihood. He did not teach non-attachment for everything. There are sutras talking about how to be a good husband, how to be a good wife, how to be a good son, how to be a daughter. Yeah. There are sutras teaching the importance of moral values. So definitely not like moral value, that's an attachment. That's a narrative. You know, not attachment. So there's necessarily things that we have to have to help us live. But the detrimental ones and our suffering comes from attachment to things that, whether things including people, phenomena, objects, that are which nature is to develop and flourish, change, evolve. We want them to be permanent, separate, independent, possessable. Then suffering comes. Suffering comes. The other day I was talking to one of my students. I have some distant, long distance students. And we talk through Skype regularly. He's been practicing very hard. The things that used to get to him at work, you know, people taking advantage and so on, manipulation. He's been using the Hua Tou Koan method. What is it? What is this moment? And when he was working, his co-worker, whom he was helping out of kindness, because he's been their senior, these are people that's junior to him in the company, started to assign work to him. He's taking extra time out of his own personal work to help them to get started on this project, because he's done them before. And these people start to request him to do work. So as soon as he saw the vexations come, right? Yeah. Anguish, suffering. As soon as it comes, he asked, "What is it?" And then they suddenly vanished. emotion, including the automatic and the physiological responses that most of us all know what I'm talking about. Everything is impermanent, everything is interconnected, but we can't behave that way. Why? Because when the onset of fear or any other emotions arise, it doesn't come just cerebrally, like, oh, here's a narrative, I fear this, I fear that. It's physiological. It's muscle memory. Stress hormones are being flushed out through your body. Right? So you feel it in your gut. You feel it not only cerebrally, but emotionally and physiologically. The good news is that what sustains even the physiological responses even when the stress hormones already flushed out, that you are ready for the fight or flight, you are in that mode even in this state, it can suddenly vanish, be pacified. What sustains that is our habitual pattern of grasping, because we have habitually lived our lives to hold on to this, to hold on to it, because this concrete, it is what we feel, is what we identify. Yeah. He had an insight of emptiness. In that crescendo, suddenly, self-grasping suddenly, temporarily, I should say, put it down. It wasn't a complete seeing self nature awakening experience, but suddenly he was able to put down and physiological changes suddenly occurred. That's the power of how things actually are. If you adapt your life, if you live your life in accordance with how things actually are, flow, connectedness, no vexations. No vexations. No suffering. Are you able to function? Yes. You able to think? Yes. But in the midst of that, you can respond to the world, and you can have thoughts, but your thought patterns would have changed. It's as if they're just thoughts, and there's no attachment there. As if there's feelings, no attachment there, no one there, and you can respond to the world. It's unfathomable, right? How is that possible? It's not like you become distant to your own feelings and thoughts, like depressed or disconnected. It's not like that. You feel more connected. You feel connected to everything, including garbage on the ground. People yelling. Chaos. And you are them. Yet, nothing's you. bandages. Stability, clarity, and joy. Doesn't that sound nice? This is not a, it's not dream. It's not fantasy. This is just the opposite. Most of us live our lives according to our perception of the world, skewed by our own baggage, conditioned by our own narrative of things. That is dream. That is imagination. An imagined, reified self against a world out there. A student of mine is he's still in this state. It's been 2 weeks now. Can he work? He's working very hard, very complicated. It's a result of practice. Is he happy? Very happy. Not happy from possessing things, which you have fear of losing. So there's always this anxiety there. Not happy from sugar or drugs. Happy, or rather joy, from sense of stability, stable. The burden of attachment released. Why is that? Because he's in closer accord with how things are. And that's not even seeing self-nature. Seeing self-nature is much more deeper than that. An extension of that. That is awakening. Now, this awakening is not something from outside. It's something you get from outside, get from people. You are the state. That's your true nature. Flow and connectedness. Without possessing. So the experience of seeing our true nature, the nature of how things are, the world, comes about through practice. How? By learning. First of all, by hearing what our true nature is, which is freedom, and understanding from two perspectives, impermanence and connectedness, right? Temporal and spatial. If every view that you have, every experience that you have, every opinion that you have, actually is contingent on everything else, then when you're at a meeting, a board meeting, everyone's trying to assert their own views. As long as the final project is done, there's no need to claim anything, as if it's claim your opinion as yours, because it is not. You learned it from someone else. Your views of things come from someone else. Everything is just in this complex flow of conditioning. Nothing claimable, nothing possessable, nothing reifiable. How free is that? It's not to have no views. Sharing views to accomplish a task, have a board meeting or whatever meeting, sharing the views. Someone don't take your view, It's not mine anyway. No vexations. See? Now, where does vexation come? This person stole my view. My view. See? And I'm not happy about it. I want this moment to be other than what it is. I want to be rewarded, right? Acknowledged, recognized for something that belongs to others. It's connected to everyone. See? And this is extendable to people. People, your family members. It's very hard for parents to not claim their own children as theirs. Mothers, why? Because it actually came out of me, right? It came out, right? But all mothers know that your children can actually talk back at you. They can actually disagree with you. Isn't that amazing? He or she are just her, his own human being. Huh? I remember when Zia first disagreed with me. It was an amazing experience. Like, what? It's amazing when your own kids have a mind of their own. True love is to allow those that you love to flourish and to live on their own. Whenever there's possession, control, you're suffering and your partner is suffering, or your children is suffering, your family member. Yeah. Do you agree? Yeah. Allowing them to be on their own, allowing sentient beings. Sentient being is a Buddhist jargon for all people, all living things, right? Allowing sentient beings to flourish, to experience, to suffer. To awaken is true love. When they suffer, yes, you try to help, but you will see that every sentient being have his or her own karma. There's something that's just unstoppable. Unstoppable. Like Shakyamuni Buddha. He tried to save his own clan. We're talking about his father, stepmom, uncles, whole family from dying 3 times by another clan. India was not unified. It's basically different clans fighting, right? He knew this other clan was going to wage war on the Shakya clan. He went in his begging round, stood in front of the path of the soldiers. And because he was holy, the general from the other clan says, because of you, we will return. day. Second time, went another route. Oh, Shakyamuni Buddha. He's around here. He's the Buddha. We're going to destroy his family. We'll take another route. Shakyamuni Buddha went back around, went the other route. A little early that day. The other route. And all the soldiers stopped. The general called back. Third time. Can't stop. It's the collective karma of his clan and the other clan to wage war. So he did not lose one person. The whole clan wiped out. Did you know that? Shakyamuni Buddha's clan, Shakya clan, wiped out. Chief disciple in supernatural power. Maha Modgayayana. Modgayayana. One of 10 great disciples of the Buddha. He was number one in supernatural power. Clairvoyance, manifesting multiple places at the same time. You know, ubiquity. Power of ubiquity. Power of clairvoyance. Power of knowing the past. He has one major karma that he couldn't overcome. Because of his charisma and his ability to teach, he brought over 500 of his previous teachers, disciples, converted to become Shakyamuni Buddha's disciple. Same thing with his buddy, Shariputra, wisdom number one. Each of them brought 500. So the Buddha Sangha expanded from a few to 1,000 all of a sudden. His teacher was extremely jealous. So his teacher, previous teacher, hired an assassin to take him out. And because Mahamogadhyayana was clairvoyant, he knew exactly what's coming and who's coming and how they plan. So he was supposed to do alms begging on one route. He sees in front of him three assassins hiding in the bushes. He goes, time to go the other way. So he turns around and goes the other way. Never passed there. The route he always take. Missed. Second time. He knew what was coming. Avoided it. Third time. He saw it in his own past karma. So he continued on his path. He knows what is coming. Guess how he was killed? By deer horns. Smashed to pieces. Three people. Delimbed him. How do you say? Decapitated. Deer horns. Spikes. After he's dead, the assailants left him. He reassembled himself. He wanted to, before he exit to Nirvana, he wanted to say goodbye to his teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha. You can take this story as legend, myth, or, but there's a moral tale to this. He reassembled himself. You can picture what that reassembled body looks like. Goes in front of Buddha. Buddha, pay my last debt. I will leave you today. And I apologize for leaving, entering to Nirvana before you. Shakyamuni Buddha says, it's okay. It's all good. No, he didn't say that, actually. he said, it's okay. And he gave a teaching on Mahamogyagyayana's past lives, the workings of karma. So true love is, yes, to love a living person, someone, your family, your partner, your children, your friends, love them to allow them to flourish, but also includes, of course, you're going to help them to the best of your ability, but there will be a moment in which you cannot stop their karma. And true love means letting go. There's one kind of love in the world. There's one kind of love in the world that's called letting go and allowing living beings to flourish and still love them. That is wisdom and compassion. Compassion, what is compassion? Compassion is just the expression of wisdom. It's not letting people step over you, walk over you, you have no view, you have no opinion. That's just that's not compassion. So we have to let go. We have to let go to love. Likewise, the object of our fear on tonight's talk, it seems like I haven't been talking about fear tonight. Object of our fear. We have to let go. Because what lies in the center of this fear is me. I. Mine. That is why we can't let go. You may think, I fear this because that's really scary, but it's really about, like, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna not exist. Just like love. You may feel that, I love you so much, I'm gonna give you X, Y, and Z. I can't live without you. How many of you have said that? Raise your hand. Come on. No one? Oh, all of you have wisdom and compassion. Right? That's because we cannot let go of ourselves. So, someday in the Manakana Sutra list five types of fear for a bodhisattva practitioner. First one is fear of not having livelihood after giving away everything. So it tries to reserve things, preserve things, keep a little bit for tomorrow. You know? Despite the fact that others really need it. That's the first type of fear that one must overcome. What is that center around? Self-attachment. It's pretty clear, right? Self-preservation. Second type. Fear of bad reputation. A bad name. Of being a bodhisattva practice, and also criticisms. The other side, a flip side of this, criticism of bodhisattva practice, of course, yourself, your practice, and the Dharma. Dharma doesn't need you to be protected. Some people claim that they do things for the sake of Dharma. That's just for the sake of yourself. So fear of criticism, getting a bad name, a bad rep, that is also what? At the core of this is what? Self-referential. See? And you'll see all of these, all of the fears that it lists actually has self in the center. The third one, fear of death, which I've mentioned a little bit. Perhaps the core of all of our fears, right? In one form or another. Fear of an ending. Right? If nothing can produce something, suddenly, then perhaps there's an end. But as we know, everything comes from something else. Therefore, there's no beginning and there's no end. So, death is just a word, a placeholder for change and connectedness. So when we die, there will be continuity. We will become something else. And if the momentum of our lives have been geared towards one particular way, towards one direction, then when we expire, when this shell expires, it will continue in that direction. It's like a tree. Since its beginning, you've tied it with a rope towards west or east or whatever direction. When the tree grows, it will grow towards that direction. And when it eventually collapses, it will fall to that direction. That direction, what I'm talking about, that rope, what I'm talking about, is your actions of body, speech, and mind. How you have lived your life. How you have shaped and tied your life for what purpose? So when you expire, that's where you will go. So for us practitioners, we practice for the sake of others, for the benefit of others, all sentient beings, for the happiness and contentment of all people, for the freedom and ease of bodies and minds. Why? Because we are them. Everything that we have come from everything. It's a natural expression, returning to the nourishment that we have received. So, when we expire, our future, we will meet Buddha Dharma again. We will meet teacher. We will meet our fellow practitioners. Those traveling on the same path. Nothing to fear. The third one, fear of death. There is no beginning and there is no end. Everything's connected. Everything continues to flow. Fourth one. We don't have to fear this either. Fear of negative karmic rebirth. Negative karmic rebirth, which translated to modern language is our future destiny. Even this life, future destiny. No fear if you don't live a guilty life, a harmful life. No need to fear. Live a virtuous life. Live a life guilt-free. Live a life by wisdom and compassion. Maybe a lot to remember, but if you just practice, recognize self-grasping and let it go in how you love people. Let it go in how you care for people. Let it go in how you proactively give suggestions at your meeting, but you don't attach to your own ideas. If you live like that, you will live a life in wisdom and compassion, in alignment with selflessness, instead of self-referentiality. The last fear is kind of strange. Some of you. It says, fear of giving teaching to multitudes of people. It's a kind of a strange list. Because a bodhisattva needs to contact different types of people. Their practice depends on interacting with others. That's how they fulfill their practice. That's how they learn skillful means. That's how they learn patience. That's how they learn how to love, how to let go. Right? So, fear from social anxiety, you may translate that to. But the bodhisattva's whole career is to interact with people. Yeah. So, these are the five fears in this particular text. And each and every one of them centers around self. Whether it's your reputation, right? Your own preservation, your own end, right? Where your future will be, how to relate to multitudes of people. See? No problem. Because no self-grasping. You don't have to worry about what other people think about you. You see? Can you remember the five? First one? Preservation. Is someone taking notes? Hannah? Preservation. Yvonne? What's the second one? You forgot your glasses? So what are you writing there? Bad reputation. Bad rep. Or criticism, right? What other people think about you. Fear of this, fear of that. Imagine living a life like that. You know, fearing like that. Third one? Death. Oh, remember that one. Fourth one? Negative karmic destiny, right? Future destiny. Fifth one? Public speaking? relating to multiple types of people. Right? You can't fear people. The bodhisattva fear people? How do they save all beings if they fear people? They can't relate to them. Imagine that. Like, I really want to save you, but let me just send you an email to tell you how are. You got to connect with them. You got to relate to them. Right? So, the opposite of this five would be what? That's how we can learn to overcome fear. The principle, of course, is learn to let go of self-referential narratives, images you try to contain, you try to hold on to, reify. Of course we need, I'm not talking about don't think, you know, don't use our intellect. I'm not saying that. No feelings, I'm not saying that. We can have a lot of feelings, but they don't evolve around the benefit and the harm of yourself. So the first one, of course, this is the principle, but for these five, a positive spin on these five, fear, is what? First one? How would you spin this? What is the first one?
Self-preservation.
Yeah.
Generosity.
Generosity. Preserve. If I give too much, I should preserve a little bit. Generosity. We can't give material goods. We can give time. We can give our friendship. right? We can give our concern. We can give a lot. We can give loving speech. We can do that. We can make a practice out of it. Whatever you practice, whatever kind of generosity you practice, it will begin to have an effect on the way you relate to others and yourself. Even other things. If you say, I will give loving speech, kind speech to all my friends 5 times a day, that will start to have a transformative experience. Yeah. So you say, Nevo, I love how you match up the blue shirt with blue jeans and blue shoe wrap. Yeah. Well, you can say that. Someone wears a shirt that matches the color of the eyes. I love that color. I hate it. No. Don't say that. No, you may hate it. You tell yourself, that person love it. That's why they wear this like this. So appreciate other. Allow them to flourish. Right? Jim, you often come with that yellow shirt. Wonderful! We love it too. You know, loving speech or helping someone 5 times a day. What? Generosity, first one. Second one, how would you spin fear of criticism? Reputation. How would you spin that positively around? By the way, Buddhism has this tendency. It's just a cultural background of always explaining things in the negative. You know, even loving kindness meditation, it says, may you be free from danger. May you be free from sickness and illness and disease. You know, may you be... Come on, spin it around positively. So I'm trying to advocate another way to see this in 21st century. We don't need to do that. We don't need that. Okay? So, criticism. Your own reputation.
If we don't see our opinions like belong to ourselves, that coming from everybody else,
yeah,
it's not mine. So if people criticize my opinion, it's not criticizing me.
Yeah. Your opinion, your views come from the benefit of others. Your education, your experiences. So when you share your views, don't attach to them as yours. Right? So you can say, I'm offering back the views to all of you. My opinion. Huh? And when people don't take it, it's okay. For example, if you someone one of the jealous non-Buddhist outer path practitioner. The Shakyamuni was too charismatic, took away, converted all of his students. So he came scolding at Shakyamuni Buddha. Scolding. Yelling. And Buddha just sat there. Listened. Accepted. At the end, the Buddha says, and the guy says, what do you have to say about this? The Buddha said, when you give a present, when you offer a present to someone, if they don't accept it, what does the present belong to? Yourself, right? Actually, when he said that, that person, he's converted to. He was enlightened by it. You know? So you offer your views to others, and they don't accept it, or someone criticizes you, like the Buddha, you don't accept it, don't have to yell back. Don't have to scream back. It's their view. It's their construct of you. It's their imagined notion of you. Some of them may be based on facts, but even those facts are perceived by them. Right? So if you don't accept them, it belongs to them. Does that make sense? No. If you get angry, that means you accepted them. It's like someone hit you with a stick, you take away the stick, and let me help you with that. You hit someone with a stick. That's what we do. Someone criticize you, you take them. How dare you criticize moi? Right? Me. And then you already accepted that view. See, we're busy living our own dreams. Now you're busy living other people's dream of you? Too busy. Too busy. Let's take care of your own dream. Get yourself, wake up from your own dream. Right. So criticism. How do you transform death? Fear of death. An end. How do you transform that?
No beginning and no end.
No beginning, no end.
There is no reason to fear that. It is just discontinuing.
Acceptance.
Appreciation. You come from everything else. Now, it doesn't wait till you end to return to everything else. Moment to moment, there's everything. It's not that at the end, okay, I come from everything else. At the end, I have to give it back. Darn it. You know, I have to return it back or something. You borrowed it. No, every moment.
Fully engaged in every moment. Yeah. More I'm here now.
Yeah, you have to, by the way, you have to act like him too, like fully engaged. And let me add a little bit. Gratitude. That will allow you to be fully engaged. You can be fully engaged and hateful, fully engaged in scolding. You could be, you know. So always gratitude, right? Gratitude, humbleness. Right? Everything, every time you think you are experiencing harm, you are experiencing your own end. Where am I going to go? It's gratitude for present here. I'll give you a slogan. You can recite. If you need to. Yeah. Ingratitude. You are me. And yet, I'm not you. Can you remember that? And this you doesn't mean one person. It can mean your body. Your own life, this you refer to. Talk to yourself. If you fear your own death, you're me. Fully accept. You have your own history. You did have your own history. You are me. Yet, I'm not you. I'm not limited to this. Okay? Yeah. Fourth one. How do we spin the fourth one?
Oh my gosh.
Fourth one is what?
Karmic destiny.
If you practice virtue, if you practice the precepts, if you practice meditation, practice wisdom and compassion for self and others, nothing to fear. You will have molded your path, that rope that ties down that tree, when that tree falls, it will fall towards the direction of Dharma. You will definitely be among practitioners, and sooner, next lifetime. And you will definitely meet teacher, and sooner. And you will be among like-minded practitioners. So practice hard. Right? Nothing to fear. We learn as practitioners not to live by karma. Not to live by karma. So here's a slogan for yourself. Don't live by karma. Being pushed and pulled by things. Live by vow. Your vow will replace your karma. Because of your vow, the momentum of your vows, Bodhisattva vows, your future will be shaped. And that vow is save all beings. End all vexations. That's how you save all beings. How to end vexations? Master, limitless approaches to Dharma. Fourth, realize Buddhahood. That's the four great vows of a Bodhisattva. Right? And because of that vow, that will give you strength. Vow is a sense of direction in life. A person without direction is lost. It's lost. That's the most important thing in life. A sense of direction. Right? You have to develop it when you're young. When you're young. We have a lot of young people. Most important thing, direction in life. And if you don't have direction, even when you get old, you develop it quickly. Direction. Four great vows. Because of this direction, you will have job. You will have clothing. You will have shelter. But in shelter, in clothing, in job, there may not be direction. That means if you worry about your job, you worry about your clothing, your shelter, material things, all of your rest of your life, you'll be worrying about it. And when you get it, you will still worry about it. But if you have a direction to help people, to offer yourself for the benefit of more people around you, then you will be like a magnet. Opportunities will come. It works in reverse ways. Do you believe it?
Yeah.
That's the way it is. Because that is in accordance with how things work in the world, how things are. Interconnectedness. Flow. Last one. You will not fear people. So you tell yourself, go out and make a friend today. Right. Go out and connect with people. Don't go out of your way. You don't even have to go out of your way. There's a lot of people you meet every day. The store clerk, the person on the street, the bus driver, your neighbor. Can you do that? Yeah, we can do that. Overcoming these five fears. Transform these fears into your Bodhisattva practice. Awakened. Bodhisattva means awakened being, enlightened being, enlightened practice. So, that's how you overcome fear. Any questions? Sorry to keep you. Jim?
When I talk with people my age, not fear of death, it's fear of ongoing pain.
Physical pain? And what do you say to them?
Yeah, I agree.
The physical pain is still a preservation of self. Yeah. I want this moment to be other than what it is. It becomes a suffering. The fact is, pain, the body does its own thing. Like today I had a fever, for example, before coming. So I meditated and cooled myself down. A few months ago I had a backache. I was on crutches. The nerve pressing. The body, doesn't matter how young, how old, always has pain. But pain doesn't have to be suffering. That's what you can tell them. Well, physical pain, physical body does its own thing. Right? When there's no fear of the pain, then your stress hormones will not be flushed throughout the body. Your tolerance for pain, physical pain, will be higher. Right? Yeah. If you can accept the pain, it's just what the body does. And it won't be that painful. It's actually the resistance to pain that causes a lot of suffering. It's still a form of dying. Right? The body deteriorating. Right? So, accept. We can say, for the third one, do you remember that slogan? You are just me, yet I am not you. But most people, when they're experiencing pain, it's just, it's me, I'm having pain. Right? It's just me, me, me. So, you, is this pain? You're part of me. Yeah, I'm not you. But that probably doesn't work for those people who don't have a context, you know, of Buddha Dharma. So you can tell them this. Besides, you can have pain, but you don't need to have suffering. And you have one more secret you can tell them. You can say, I know this guy on Monday nights. You bring them over here. And they learn the Dharma. And slowly they practice. Okay? Is it useful?
Yes.
What have you gotten tonight? It's not a tricky question. What do you remember? Stood out. What's that?
Love is letting go.
Love is letting go. Wonderful. Wonderful, Jane. Anything else? Yes?
I really like how the concept of embracing the core here by death. Because, like, if we think about death as in, if we apply, for example, the death to our the image of ourselves, then like everything is like revolved around that. Like the death of ourselves, like criticism is like the death of my own self. Like,
yeah.
As I feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then social like anxiety is the death of my perception.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable with all the perception.
Yeah.
So like,
so everything is related to the death.
Like the constant of like the death.
Yeah. So, what do you do about it? Let's tackle the third one. What do you do about the fear of death?
realizing that
no beginning, no death, flow and connectedness. Yes.
What if somebody doesn't fear death? Like, how would you explain suicidal people? Or what do you think their thought process is?
A lot of suicidal people. It's a lot of self-grasping there. A lot of self-grasping. Yeah. You know, so they need Buddha-dharma. They need to see through the veil of the self. They need to practice gratitude, practice love. They need to love themselves. Love themselves and appreciate with gratitude that, you know, the self comes from everything else. So for the sake of them, live. You know. Does that answer your question? What else did you get? Anything make sense? What stood out?
It's fear comes from self.
Fear comes from self. Yeah. Good. But you know, the emotions, their nature is just come and go. They're part of me, but I'm not them. It's a dream. It's a dream that we live in, you know.
Started to talk about fear. I used to be very fearful, and now I'm not. And I don't know what happened, but I can't find fear. You know what I mean? If I look at it, I can't find what it is. It disappears.
Yeah. Yeah. Because nothing is reified into a thing. Their nature is freedom. Yeah. When you are fearful, then you can see them. Yeah. But if you're not fearful, you're trying to find them, you can't.
Even when I would never mind.
Yeah.
There was one that struck me though, like for the last Bodhisattva thing, what occurred to me right away that wouldn't be a fear of people so much as maybe leading them astray, leading them away from the
yeah. Yeah. So, just practice. Did you all hear that? Fear of not so much social anxiety, but fear of leading people astray. Right. A bodhisattva does not think that they are teaching other people. The bodhisattva sees all beings as delivering themselves. All beings already attained Buddhahood.
They couldn't be afraid of them either.
They couldn't what?
They couldn't be afraid of them either.
That's why there's no fear. But aspiring bodhisattva practitioners like us We don't think we are the one doing teaching, and those are the people who are listening. Just sharing. It's practice. We're practitioners. See? Practitioners. No claiming of anything. Like, this is my teaching or not my teaching, or you benefit from practice because of me. That's just stupid.
I guess what I was thinking of is when I would be reading like your book, The Complete Enlightenment, and all of the bodhisattvas are asking Buddha questions.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are like,
how do I do this? Yeah. But the answers, it doesn't say he doesn't answer, it doesn't teach, but subjectively, they don't think that these people get benefit because of me. That would be self-referential attachment. Right? The Buddha sees exactly what is happening and then responds. And then afterwards, no trace. Right? So, the best thing that a teacher can do is, in relation to other people, is to let go. It's to see sentient beings flourish. And they release themselves. Actually, they do release themselves. You know, in the flow of causes and conditions, the teacher's teachings or instructions or whatnot, it's just one little factor among many different factors, and their sentient beings' own history, why they can accept certain teaching, why they can accept another type of teachings. It's all sentient beings through and through. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Have a wonderful night. Be safe.